Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So, thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. How's your day? It's a beautiful, dreary Sunday morning here in Colorado. We've been having crazy weather for the past couple months. Global warming, most likely some sort of climate change indicative of some weird events going on. I have never seen so much rain here in Colorado. Like, at least I've been in this period of drought and dry season for just, like, it's been that way since I've been here. And I've lived here for almost going on 15, 16 years now. So, like, yesterday, I'm sitting in my house, and all of a sudden I get one of these really standard and normal emergency alarms, and the frequency comes through. And these things scare the shit out of Odin. Like, I'll have my Dungeons and Dragons games on Friday, and I'll be downstairs, and he'll be watching TV, and these alarms will come on the TV, and he'll just fucking run, just book it all the way downstairs. And I'm not sure what's triggering that. But we had a tornado warning in the area. And so I'm a little worried because I see the clouds and I see the gray, and I don't want my car to get just completely filled with water on the inside. So I go out to go check on my car, and my neighbors are all outside looking at the clouds, and they're looking out east, it seems, more like northeastish. And all of a sudden, my neighbor friend pulls out his phone and shows it to me, and it's a fucking tornado right there. Right on the picture. And it was far away. You know, we couldn't even see it. Like, people were trying to see if they could spot it, but, like, still, you know, like, the alarm's telling everybody to shelter in place and go inside and find a basement and get away from the windows. And, like, as soon as the front reached my apartment, hail starts getting pitched out of this thing, right? And I had pieces that were probably, like, most of the pieces, like, the average size of the hail droplets were probably about a half an inch to about an inch to an inch and a half, which is pretty big clonking pieces of ice, you know? Like, in my head, I think that could probably knock my ass out. And so I'm not going outside. Like, one time, I walked out in a middle of a hailstorm, and my intelligent brain decided that I was going to put a box over my head, and I was going to protect me. And I walked out, and about 3 seconds after leaving the back of the restaurant, because I think I was just trying to get to my car, a piece of ice dinged off the box and hit my foot, damn near broke my toe. And so now I refuse to go outside when there's hail or any sort of ice going around. And so I'm seeing all these pieces hitting outside, and there's so much hail, they're hitting the grass and bouncing back up like trampolines. And it looks just beautiful, but I'm also scared because, you know, and I'm like, well, what if my window breaks? You know, like, I don't know what's going to happen if my living room window breaks because it's right there, you know. And so I'm just watching it, and it was awesome in the structural sense of that word, awe. You know, I was in awe of the power of this storm. You know, and there's been so many big supercells and so many thunderstorms that, like, the pervasive essence of change is in the air, you know? And, like, I feel like the world is mirroring all of our inner microcosms of experience here. And maybe we have a lot of other climate change on the inside as group society and groupthink within our minds we have to work on, as well as being able to weather the outside, you know? So my purpose here on this show, The Gingerbread Man, I feel that I stand on two legs. They might be slightly misshapen, whatever the word choice is for that one. But I feel I stand on love, and my idea of love is unpartisan. It's unjudgmental. I consider it an unconditional form of love. I practice love with strangers, and it has absolutely no physical or sexual orientation in any way, shape, or form. The way I see love is as attention. And attention is another idea that we're going to further dig into later in the show. But how can we attend fully to the other? I see the world and everything outside my being as this other. And I used to call it nature, and some might call it the universe, and some of a ritualistic bent might call it God, you know, but there is this essence of something that is outside of this central idea of who I think I am. And I'm not convinced that separation is real. But within our lives and how we conduct ourselves when we go and we have interactions with any and everybody around us, is we have to conduct ourselves from this sense of I or me or this thing, you know? And so I consider love a way of approach when we conduct relationships with outside. And how can we fully be attentive to the outside as we bring it into our inside? You know, I think the more further we love something, we get lost in the connectivity of the relationship and the interaction, because we begin to lose that sense of central oriented selfishness, if that makes any sense at all. Like, the more we practice an unconditional form of love and the more we give and we sacrifice for the other, the more we find ourselves inside of it and outside of it at the same time. It's full of misnomers. It's full of oxymoron when it comes to trying to depict this endless essence of love that I just see that is tappable by anybody at any time. And the other leg I feel I stand on is this idea of self-starting creativity. Now, in the workforce, some employees are considered self-starters. You know, some people have to be ran like an RC car. Some people have to have a lot of instruction. And I personally believe with enough education and enough time, people evolve into self-starters where they're able to conduct their own work and be able to see the things that they have to do. So, I feel that our lives, my life in particular, because that's the one I'm working on, but anybody's life is an artistic expression of their being. When we live our lives, we make choices constantly. We have an impact constantly on all the other people that we're interacting with. And just as my last little segment on love, perchance, described, we are stuck and dependent on every other thing around us. So, as we go and we make choices, when we impact others because of our dependence, because we're dependent on our own things and how our own choices are going to be, but everybody else is also just as dependent on us, whether or not we want to see it or not, you know, the quantum entanglement and foundations of love everywhere are holding everybody into these like mutual systems of creation. And I think it's magnificent, and I find it compelling, and it excites me, you know, which is part of the reason why I always had an easy time going into school in the sciences, because learning for me and finding anything out about the universe and out about humanity, about my own emotions, about my own being, and my evolutionary history in it all has always just been so exciting. I've always been just fundamentally pulled towards learning, you know? And so because I found it so exciting, it's always felt so important to me. And so the things that hit my brain stick. And I've been able, through effort, I've been able to start forming a system of meaning for myself that veers into spirituality and all the hoodoo-ness. And I've built that starting from a very strict countercultural idea of atheism that I felt most of my upbringing because of my resistance to the world, because of my resistance to the other, and because I grew up in a church of meaning that felt like it was incompatible with who I was. And so I've had to build my own. And that's a work in progress, really. I haven't built it yet. But I am motivated to work on it. And I personally believe that through our influence on others, we can make other people feel creative. And we can make other people want to go find their own motivations. And that might not have anything to do with what I'm interested in, or what you're interested in, or your parents, or your teachers, or your college, or your place of work or vocation, or your society, or what the group narrative says about who you are, if you're a man or a woman, or anything. It has nothing to do with that, because you can build whatever you decide at any moment, and you can change and be flexible. And that's sort of what I want to get into today, is this flexibility. And this is an idea that I've spoken about on the show before, but I want to talk about habits and what a habit is and how we form them and what it feels like to be in a habit. You know, what does it feel like to change a habit? It's hard, right? It's easy to start something. So a habit is just something that we've done more than once. And at some point in time, some piece of our psyche has decided that it's advantageous, or, oh my goodness, there's so much water going on in my apartments right now. But at some point, somebody decided that, somebody inside ourselves, some piece, you know, but somebody decided inside our heads, a little voice goes, you know, like, hey, that worked. Catalog that, put it in a folder. We're going to need that later, because we made it through this moment. Woo! Survival instinct is on, right? And so I feel that it's super easy to find ourselves in these cyclical cycles, is what it really is. I'm going to tell an old metaphor that I used a long time ago, and I had an old episode on it if you want to dig a little further into it. I think that episode was called RC Cars in the Snow. But basically, the idea of this metaphor is, imagine that you are in a very cold and inhospitable, hazardous environment. You're in the middle of the forest. I mean, you have clothes, you're shacked up, but you are trudging along. Like, there's resistance, there's wind in your face, there's a lot of snow. There's like 6 feet of it, and you don't have fucking any sort of snowshoes or any sort of help, you know, and you're just walking along, trudging. You come up to a big opening in this shitty, snowy forest, and there's like a field, right? And in the middle of the field, there could be perhaps a walkway where someone who's also in this forest walk through it. If you come up to that and you see this walkway that's in front of you, what do you think your options are in fording this valley and getting across of it? You know, like, are you going to walk and pave a fresh new path through this thick snow, or are you going to walk through the path that has always been walked before you? And the brain makes this value judgment all the time when it comes to deciding what we're going to do. And if we've walked a certain path before, the brain's like, well, that's a lot easier just to fire all those neurons. Let's go that way again, you know? And that's my metaphor for habits. You know, it's that easy. Life is difficult. And so we have to form all sorts of different strategies for how we're going to confront this thing, right? So we've done it more than once, and now we've formed a habit. We've walked a path, and bam. Now, there could be positive things that we could do for ourselves. There's things and decisions that we've made in the past that have had positive inclinations towards our overall well-being. And there could also be negative, you know, consequences for our actions as well. But I would hazard to say that over time, certain positive habits could turn into negative ones, and circumstances can change. And so this value judgment of positivity in how we perceive our habits might be bullshit, you know? So this just means we have to be more vigilant to watch and be mindful of the independent moment and how things are happening in the now, which isn't reflective of any past event, which is what our habits are looking at. Our managers in our brain are looking at all these things and categorically saying, all right, we do this, this, or this, you know? But in the moment, none of that shit is there, you know? So if we're vigilant and we're watching and we're looking at how this situation or this moment serves us, and how whatever serves me is entangled with what serves you, right? So yet again, what has worked in the past, we can't just think that it's always going to be a good thing. We have to stay aware and mindful in the moment. And that's where habitudes can dissolve. That's where we can form new habits and new choices. And that's where we find new paths that we can walk, and we might be able to run across an outfitter in the middle of the forest. You know, just to fuck this metaphor up, there's an outfitter giving out thicker clothes and snowshoes. Now you have a much more ability and flexibility to choose new choices, right? Like, it doesn't always have to stay so hazardous. So how does this moment serve me or you or anybody? I spoke about this concept last week that I want to return to, just because I really liked it. It was this, and I felt like I didn't explain it too well. It's this idea on stupidity, and it's this new definition on how to label something as stupid or not, I guess. And all it really has to do is this mutual influence between two entities, me and you, which fits into my dynamism and my own philosophizing about this sort of stuff. So if something happens and me and you are involved and it benefits me and it benefits you, this could be considered an intelligent move. And we can calculate these things, you know? In utilitarianism, which is another philosophy that I've covered, you know, there's always these value judgments for happiness on how the most people can be made happy, but yet again, that's murky. So if I do something that benefits me and it harms or takes something away from you, then I'm being a robber. I'm being a thief. I'm stealing from society. If I do something that benefits you but harms me, I'm acting helpless or hapless, right? Within this metaphor. And if I do something that doesn't benefit me and it also doesn't benefit you, so I'm harming everybody and I'm hurting everybody in this situation, that's just fucking stupid. And it gets murky, and this is too simplified, just like any system is overall too simplified when we try to explain reality, right? So for instance, is a positive benefit worth it if others lose out? Sometimes, yes. There's always been these judgment calls in mass society where some people have had to lose out. And whether or not that's okay or not, for how we feel about it, it's happened, you know? And is a sacrifice worth it if everyone benefits? So is my personal sacrifice, if I make myself helpless for other people, can that still be noble? And I'd also argue that perhaps yes. So it's no one right way to always act intelligently. I think it would be almost impossible, and we'd kill ourselves with all the ethical conundrums if we tried to. So these things come in to play when we are making these calculations on how we want to treat others and how we want to grow ourselves. And everything is so entangled with everything else. So changing habits is much harder. Like being able to take something that is long established that we've been doing for a lot, just if we've replicated the action so many times, we can get a very well-worn path. And this can be very frustrating when we want to make changes. In the spirit of honesty, you know, and I'm sure you've heard me say these things on the show before, and they're similar, but I want to stop smoking, you know, eventually. I want to be able to not inhale smoke anymore, period. But that action's hard for me to put down. And it's even part of my show. I smoke at the beginning. It's my introduction, you know, because I made a trope out of smoking, you know. But at the end of the day, eventually, one day, I don't want to inhale smoke anymore, you know. And then I'm addicted to anger as a response. My therapist's therapist, sorry, I don't know why I made that plural there. She always asks me, how has this anger served you in the past? You know? Because at one point, just like I was just discussing, my habitudes decided that this was an okay way to approach a situation, how to handle something. That's not always the case. But I do think that there's ways that we can make ourselves flexible, some actions that we can do that I think I found have been pleasant in my life, and that I believe has led to some sort of brain growth or at least some leniency in my decision making. So I like to drive different routes to places all the time. And as an example, my parents and one of my best friends that I go play Dungeons and Dragons with all the time, they live in the neighborhood next to my neighborhood on the other side of this big boulevard street. And it's very suburban, and it's just miles and miles of all these cookie cutter houses. And all the neighborhood designs is like figure eights and donuts with circles, and some of them connect to each other. But it's very confusing. And so, over the last 2 years since I've been playing with him, because we play all the time and I go see my parents all the time, whenever I go into that neighborhood, I'll find a different access point and I'll take random roads. And I try to do it with an open-mindedness, really. I wanted to have a openness, really, to figuring out the neighborhood. And I knew that my memory and my short term wasn't strong enough for me to want to learn it. And if I approached it that way, I'd get anxious. And as soon as I started trying to remember where I was going in these neighborhoods, I'd always get lost. And so I just would take different routes and I'd go with it. And over time, taking so many different routes, I have that neighborhood in the back of my head and it's just engraved there. And I did it unconsciously because it was such a slow process. You know, and so when I come home from work, I'll try to take different paths home every day. You know, I hate driving the same way every time. It's a really good way to make Groundhog's Day feel really fucking stale, you know? I like to try working ambidextrously too. So my right-handed thinking, so my left brain, because the left brain controls the right side of the body and the right brain controls the left side of the body. But I've always been incredibly right-handed to the point that my left hand was just almost unusable. And so going into work and learning how to cook is an ambidextrous skill. And in my current job, the way that it's taught, you have to use both spatulas. It's not a one spatula gig. I don't think most of them are. But you know, working with two spatulas when you're very right-hand dominant is hard at first, and you see a lot of people struggle with it. But through effort, I have learned how to work with both hands very well to the point that I feel like I'm working whole-brainedly. I don't feel half and half. I can trust the left side of my body. And that came through direct, you know, effort. And the physiology and the physical things that we do in our lives can also have a mirrored effect on the mental machinations and how we feel emotionally about them too. And so I make these practices because I think that they make me more flexible. That's why I want to share it. Not reacting immediately. We have this gut impulse to immediately bark or say something or validate ourselves when something comes up. But with practice and patience, we can hold our tongue and we can wait and listen. And I find this very compelling. So, once we begin to listen and we hear the other, we start to lose that little self and we go into the outside. And all of a sudden, we can feel empathetically, and that physical construct of the mirror neurons begins to work and we see how other person feels, right? This can only happen if we don't react immediately and shut it all down with our own impulse to speak or respond, you know? And that is hard, and that takes patience, and that's also trainable. And I see a relationship with that and working ambidextrously in physical actions and also taking different paths and choosing to do things differently from day to day, even if we have the same job every day. So, in the spirit of openness, I want to get into a topic I want to speak more about next week, but it's this idea of that inner intuition. What is intuition? Right? Intuition is like an inner voice. It feels like it's me, you know, but sometimes it seems to come from just left field, like it about-faced out of nowhere, right? I feel like some people would lead themselves to believe that their intuition is the voice of God, or it could be nature's instinct that is genetically wrapped up in our memories of all these habitudes, like we're speaking about in the beginning of the show. I think it could be a higher version of me, a higher you, the transcendent self. If it's already there, if it's fully formed, is this Socrates' memory being real learning? You know, that's a taboo to an old idea on the show as well, if you want to go listen about the Greeks and see my opinion of some of Socrates. But Socrates believed that we never learned anything because every single bit of knowledge that is ever there is already in my brain or your brain and the collective brain and this world of forms. And this is validated by some reflexes in science. You know, baby feet can be just, if you tickle the bottom of their heel, they'll make walking motions because they're already primed somehow to know the motion to walk, and that's part of how they start. Reflex, instinct, pulls. If you have a baby, you throw them into a pool, they'll hold their breath for a while. Not that I would ever try it. It sounds terrifying. Somebody did. You know, so we have these instinctual reflexes within us to help us preserve ourselves, to help us keep us safe, and also to help us prime to learn some of the most important things that we do as humans, such as walking or talking or breathing. But is there a moral reflex? Is there an instinct for what is right? Is there an instinct for ethics? Is there an instinct for value? Virtue. What's the best thing that we can do? What is the right way to be a human? Is there an instinctual basis for that? I'm not too sure. I listened to a really interesting podcast, though, this week from this guy named Stephen West. He does an amazing podcast called Philosophize This. He's been doing it forever. He's one of my heroes. I don't know if you'd ever listen to this, but man, you're amazing if you do. But he was talking about this one character called Simone Weil, and she was consumed with this idea of learning environments and how people learn the best, how people can live most fully involved in their lives. And she thought that this had to do with attention, with being able to be fully attentive and present in our lives, which doesn't have to do with rationalizing and chewing on thought forms, which leads me to believe to this very Buddhistic idea of being. She'd have classes outside where people would just be very free and just inquisitive. You know, how do you become the environment? How do you become open to discovery? How can you fall into knowledge? This makes me think of Ram Dass and how we can be the best environment for each other, and how the best thing I can do for me is work on me. The best thing that you can do for me is work on you. There we go. That's the right way. You know, it's this entanglement of the golden rule. How can we be open to new knowledge? Is it that we are an antenna from the outside and that everything that ever was is already out there, like Socrates said? Is there a world of forms? Or does pure chance and chaos allow this source of reason to spontaneously create, which I lean more towards this chaos element? Who knows what is going to be? Maybe nothing's right. But can we stand in the way of our own intuition? Can we block up a connection to what's outside of the box? Can we instill insight? Can we see the flashes of introspectivity that blend into all of the external prediction that we can do with it if we become mindful and become more attentive? I'd love to dig more into this kind of stuff, but I've been talking for way too long, and I gotta go grab a quotation so that we can wrap this up well. I love doing this, guys. Especially if you're here at the end of the episode. I'm so grateful to have you here. This opportunity to be able to try to help, and this is helping me too. I consider this an audio diary of sorts. So don't take anything I say as a recipe for anything. You know, maybe I'm ass backwards and I'm wrong about a lot of things. And I'm sure in 2 years I'll listen to this and I'll have a lot of different opinions on where I'm at even then. But at the end of the day, just knowing that you're here with me and we're able to make this space together, it makes me very happy. And so I hope you go and you be loving, and I hope you go be creative in your life and you be the most colorful and spontaneous, amazing creature that ever breathed and existed. Thank you. Today I'd like to read from the Bhagavad Gita. This is one of my favorite sections. In it, Arjuna asks Krishna to show him his true form, the form of all, of being able to see the entire universe at the same time. This makes me think of that scene from the second Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the second book, where one of the characters is forced in prison to view the entire universe at the same time, and it's supposed to drive people crazy. It's like an execution method. And Arjuna almost loses it. But I love this scene. It makes me think of what's beyond the veil and how sometimes we should have gratitude that we don't have to hold the universe and we don't have to see it all at the same time. Maybe that's a good thing. Here goes. I've heard the words of truth, but my soul is yearning to see thy form as God of this all. If thou thinkest, O my Lord, that it can be seen by me, show me, O God of yoga, the glory of thine own supreme being. Krishna says, by hundreds and then by thousands, behold, Arjuna, my manifold celestial form of innumerable shapes and colors. Behold the gods of the sun and those of fire and light, the gods of storm and lightning, and the two luminous charioteers of heaven. Behold, descendant of Bharata, marvels never seen before. See now the whole universe with all the things that move and move not, and whatever thy soul may yearn to see, see it all as one in me. But thou never canst see me with these thy mortal eyes. I'll give thee the divine sight. Behold my wonder and glory. I see in thee, when Arjuna saw in that form countless visions of wonder, eyes from innumerable faces, numerous celestial ornaments, numberless heavenly weapons, celestial garlands and vestures, forms anointed with heavenly perfumes. The infinite divinity was facing all sides, all marvels in him containing. If the light of a thousand suns suddenly arose in the sky, that splendor might be compared to the radiance of the Supreme Spirit. And Arjuna saw in that radiance the whole universe in its variety, standing in a vast unity in the body of the God of Gods. Trembling with awe and wonder, Arjuna bowed his head, and joining his hands in adoration, he thus spoke to this God. Arjuna says, I see in thee all the gods, O my God, and the infinity of the beings of thy creation. I see God Brahma on his throne of lotus and all the seers and serpents of light. All around I behold thy infinity, the powers of thy innumerable arms, the vision from thy innumerable eyes, the words from thy innumerable mouths, and the fire of life of thy innumerable bodies. Nowhere I see a beginning or middle or end of thee, O God of all, form infinite. I see the splendor of an infinite beauty which illumines the whole universe. It is thee, with thy crown and scepter and circle. How difficult thou art to see! But I see thee as fire, as sun, blinding, incomprehensible. Thou art the imperishable, the highest end of knowledge, the support of this vast universe. Thou, the everlasting ruler of the law of righteousness, the spirit who was and who is at the beginning. I see thee without beginning, middle, or end. I behold thy infinite power, the power of thy innumerable arms. I see thine eyes as the sun and the moon, and I see thy face as a sacred fire that gives light and life to the whole universe in the splendor of a vast offering. Heaven and earth and all the infinite spaces are filled with thy spirit, and before the wonder of thy fearful majesty, the three worlds tremble. The host of the gods come to thee, and joining palms in awe and wonder, they praise and adore. Sages and saints come to thee, that praise thee with songs of glory. Anyways, it goes on and on for a while. Basically, all these, I feel like, are metaphors for different aspects of our inner being and the reflection of our inner being on all the variety in the outer world, all these different spectrums of everythingness. So, I hope that makes any sense. Like, when I read this section, it reminds me of when I've smoked way too much DMT and the world blows out. You know, like, basically, Arjuna's just seeing way too much, hearing way too much, all the sights, all the sounds, all the smells, sensual overload. You know, that's what's on the other side of the chasm, with all of our filtration being grace that we have, and the fact that we at least can perceive the world our way. And there's a myriad, bajillion other ways that people, not people, other beings, other creatures, and even a rock. How does an atom perceive its existence, perhaps? Anyways, I gotta get out of here and I gotta stop talking. So, I'm gonna go grab O.
Hello, people. It's Ask O today. I'm sorry I'm very loud. I just have a lot of energy.
It's okay.
Yeah!
Power! Power! He has the power!
Stop! Pick me up!
Anyways.
Yes.
Love you.
Love you.
I love you more.
Love you.
You glad to be back in school?
Yes. I'm in second grade and I also got a new principal.
Oh, you like him?
Yes.
Good stuff.
How did you already know he was a bully?
I think I met him on the way in.
When are you going to talk to other people than me? Like Calvin?
On the show?
Yeah.
I haven't had an interview in a while. I was going to do Calvin for number 100 if I can.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, thank you guys.
We're done.
Bye.
Bye.